is next.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today is Mona Hagag, and we're going to be talking about fasting as a spiritual discipline. Now, as a Muslim, when you fast, you go without not only food, but without water during the whole month of Ramadan during the daylight hours. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And how old were you when you first started doing this kind of fasting?
Well, I think I had tried to start fasting, I think, when I was a lot younger. I was maybe 9 years old, 10 years old. And my parents felt that I was a bit young for it. So they said, well, you can fast a couple hours out of the day. But I don't think I started fasting full time until I was about 13.
And this was something you wanted to do even before your parents thought you were ready to do it. Why did you want to?
Well, I think sometimes there's kind of a novelty in seeing what your family's doing, your parents are doing. You know, why aren't they eating lunch with you? And they explain to you, well, we're fasting because we want to understand what poor people are encountering, or that's at least how it's explained. Mm-hmm. So you start to develop an empathy for people who don't have what you have. And I think, you know, it's normal for children to feel that way.
Now, you're a senior in college now. Have you done this every year since you were that age?
That's correct.
And which year was the hardest?
Which year was the hardest? Wow. I think maybe when I was, I would have to say maybe like eighth grade when I was in middle school.
Huh.
It's been quite easy since then. I think those initial years are hard because, well, a lot of people joke around about this, but when you don't fast, you can't have like breath mints or like things like that. And so you're very self-conscious when you talk to people. Whereas when you're in college, you kind of overlook these things.
I see. Now, tell me a little bit about how a Muslim who is observant, who is practicing, and who wants to do this fast, how do you feel about it? You're aware that other Muslims in your family are doing it, other friends, other people who are perhaps at your mosque. But do you feel like it's an individual thing you do? Do you feel all alone, or do you feel part of a worldwide community?
I think, you know, it's a great experience to do it during the month of Ramadan. Last year, actually, I was in studio during most of the evening hours when I was in the industrial design program. So I couldn't break my fast with the people at the mosque.
Huh.
And for me, I felt a little bit more isolated in my fasting, and I just didn't really, I don't think, connected with it as well. But when I was able this semester to go to the mosque and break my fast with my fellow community members, both college students and people who are residing in Urbana-Champaign, it was a great experience. It just really opens up your heart to a feeling of family and a feeling of coming together as a community effort to really build self-development and recognition of what the eventual goals of fasting are.
Well, tell us a little bit about exactly how it works. Ramadan changes. It's a lunar, according to a lunar calendar.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But it's how many days?
It varies every year, actually. Okay. The lunar calendar varies between 29 and 30 days. So we do it according to moon sightings in North America. And each country does their own moon sighting. So we generally say just 1 month instead of giving
sure.
it how many days.
Okay. And it goes from sun up to sundown.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're very conscious of how long the days are.
Yes.
And when was the last Ramadan?
The last Ramadan. Oh, catching me off guard here. It came, the end of Ramadan came around Thanksgiving time
okay.
last year,
okay.
whereas this year is about 2 weeks earlier.
Okay. And so the daylight hours are a little bit shorter
yes.
in the fall rather than in the summer. But sometimes Ramadan is in the summer?
That's correct.
Wow. So do you try to eat something while it's still dark in the morning?
Mm-hmm. We call it sahur or sahri, depending on which ethnic background you're from. And you generally try to eat kind of a light meal. Some people have cereal. Other people have a few dates and water, just to keep you going and sustain throughout the day.
Okay. So you would eat that before the sun comes up?
Yes.
And then no water, no food, no other liquid during the whole day. Now, what if you try to do this and you're young, perhaps, and you fail? What happens if you just have to have a drink of water? What if you just can't make it through that first day and need food? Do you feel like a failure?
I think, well, it depends how old you are. I think if you're maybe 12 or 13 years old, I think it's more often overlooked. And it's kind of like, well, try harder the next day. Although, okay. I guess with any kind of personal endeavor, especially one that entails spiritual, it has that connection, you start to feel a little bit more disappointed. It's like missing a prayer by accident, or maybe you just forgot. You feel bad.
Uh-huh. Okay. And how do you deal with that feeling of feeling bad?
Well, I guess, you know, a very common theme throughout the religion, or Islam, is a continual repentance and sort of acknowledging that, yes, I have faults, but I can always turn to God or Allah and, you know, ask for that to be overlooked and, you know, for you to have to be repurified. And, you know, it's just kind of like God saying, it's okay.
So there is a concept of forgiveness that's very practical in Islam. Okay. What about when you succeed? I know, as my background is Christian, and one of the things Christians are warned about all the time is that if you succeed at some kind of a spiritual discipline, like praying so often, so many times a day or for so long, there's the danger of pride. Is that a concern in Islam?
Yes. Well, pride is something that it's really discouraged. You don't want people to become boastful or prideful of their own religious acts. However, you want them to feel a sense of self-gratification. But I think pride really comes down to the way you treat other people. Self-righteousness is something that's very frowned upon and very discouraged.
When Christians often succeed in being humble, in being charitable to somebody else, there's often the danger spiritually of then feeling proud about that.
And,
look what I did.
Yeah.
Is that a concern in Islam?
Yes. Actually, when I was reading the New Testament, we have the same ideals of when Jesus says to give with your right hand instead of your left hand.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that, or it's better to conceal when you give.
Mm-hmm. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand is
giving. You phrased it much better. And that's something that I think I've always been brought up with as a Muslim from a religious view. And so we definitely share that commonality.
Huh. When you were very young and just starting to do this fast, were there other people your age who were also doing it that you could kind of compare notes with?
Well, I grew up in a small town of about 27,000 people in East Tennessee. So there weren't too many other Muslims. There were no other Muslims in my age group or my grade that went to my school when I first started. So it was kind of, I don't know, I've been very independent. So I just kind of gauged it with what my parents were doing and things like that.
You have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have a younger brother.
Okay. So you were really a minority growing up in East Tennessee?
Yes.
Okay, as a Muslim. Tell us how you got there.
Well, as like I was telling you earlier, my parents actually met in Egypt, but my father had immigrated in the late 70s to California and did his second master's there at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And on a vacation trip back to take his mother back to Egypt, he met my mother. And soon afterwards, they got married, and my mother immigrated to the United States. Then they moved from there to Idaho, where I was born. We moved to Ohio for a bit and eventually settled in Tennessee.
Now, your mother studied business, your father studied nuclear engineering, and you're in art history.
Yes.
How do they feel about that?
Well, I think initially, when I came to the University of Illinois, it was for the marketing and psychology programs. And my parents were, you know, very, very supportive of that endeavor because Illinois is highly ranked for it. Then later on, I wanted to go into industrial design. So I switched to the School of Fine and Applied Arts. My parents didn't take that so well because neither of them really had an arts background.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was either engineering or business is what they truly understood. And then just this year I switched into art history. So they've been supportive, I think, but it was difficult to really comprehend what I was going to do with that and my future endeavors and career options.
Hmm. Now, some religions have a real sense of call for people's occupations, and there's a sense in which what you do to make a living is seen as also service to the community, making a contribution in a sense through your skills to the greater good. Is that a theme in Islam?
Yes, it definitely is. With anything that you do, if you do it with the right intention, and there's this very strong emphasis on the idea of intention in Islam. So you could be doing things that are very routine or very regular, like studying, for example, or even, you know, raking the leaves in front of your house. Both of those things, while they may not be life-changing or, you know, earth-shattering, they do hold that impact of being good work. And if you're doing things that are good, you receive reward for them. So I guess to really underline, it's the idea of integrity in what you do. Mm. And if you uphold ideals of integrity, then whatever you're doing is in service to humanity.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon about fasting as a spiritual discipline with a Muslim student at the University of Illinois, a senior, Mona Haggag, who is studying, she has been in industrial design and switched recently to art history. I want to encourage listeners to call with either a question or a comment, and I'll be giving the numbers in just a moment for people who would like to make a call to the radio station. This is a live call-in show every Sunday. And this week we'd also like to encourage listeners who might have fasted themselves, either for religious reasons or perhaps for other reasons, to call and share their experience. We had hoped actually for this program to have representatives from three different religions, each talking about fasting, and for various scheduling difficulties, we weren't able to do that, but we were very grateful Mona is able to be here in spite of having exams this week, I'm sure, like the other students. But we do want to encourage listeners to share from your own religious perspective or your own perspective, even if it's not in a particular religious tradition, of fasting as a spiritual experience. So the numbers, if you'd like to share or ask a question or make a comment, anywhere the program is heard, there's a free call you can make, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. And that is a free call even for listeners on the Internet. So if you are listening on computer far away, we've had calls even from many other states, because the program can be picked up at WILL.UIUC.EDU by then going to AM 580. So do use that 1-800 number, 222-9455. Listeners in Champaign-Urbana, we encourage you to use 333-9455, and that will access several local numbers, 333-9455. To share experience with fasting or to ask a question to our guest today, Mona Haggag. Well, we have a call already on line number one. Let's go to that caller. You're on the air.
Oh, yeah. My question is maybe a bit mundane, but I know that obviously very many countries that are predominantly Muslim are extremely hot. And I cannot imagine how someone doing manual labor can get through a day in a climate like that without any liquid. Is there something I'm missing here? How do they do this?
That's actually quite a common question, but another very important thing that comes to mind is that a lot of people in Muslim countries who are doing manual labor are unfortunately in a situation where they're at they're in poverty, and so clean water that is safe to drink isn't available to them in many cases. So if you are doing manual labor and observing Ramadan, in many cases, it's not different than your regular routine.
Hmm. Are there exceptions made for health reasons, though, if someone is sick?
Definitely.
Okay.
I actually had friends on campus who had gotten sick during Ramadan, and they had taken a few days off.
Mm-hmm. And it's not a requirement, is it? It's just a goal that's held out for people, so people can choose whether to keep the fast or not.
Oh, actually, it's considered a religious requirement if you're of age.
Okay.
And there are actually consequences if you break your fast knowingly or willingfully. And there's a period where you have to make up if you've willingfully broken your fast during the month of Ramadan. And there were no health reasons or travel exemptions and things like that. You must fast for 60 continuous days or feed the equivalent of 60 people.
Ah, interesting. How much? How do you feed them?
Three
meals a day?
I think it's something like $10 per person per day.
Interesting.
Yes. Oh. If you're pregnant, you don't have to fast. And then you make up those days by either paying that amount to people in the local community for them to have food. Mm. So you could give it to a local food bank or to your local mosque to take care of that if you have one in the area.
And is there an exception for a woman during her menstrual period?
Yes, you would not fast on your menstrual period.
Okay. And we have another caller waiting on line number 4. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please. Yes, line 4.
Hi.
Yes, go right ahead.
My question was pertinent to this issue about exceptions for medical reasons. I was raised Catholic, and we'd had also rules, I guess, for fasting. And one that comes to mind is not eating before you went to Mass, certain period of time. And I recall as a child when I came of age to be able to do this, following this rule, and in part because I think my family never got up early enough to have an ample breakfast far enough in advance of the time that we would have to start fasting, I would often go to church without having enough food. And I can recall fainting at least 10 different times at church for this very reason. And in part, too, for another reason, you know, I was, as an adult, tested for anemia and hypoglycemia and other types of things. And I'm a sort of person who really needs to have frequent meals throughout the day. And so this kind of thing would, you know, was really not appropriate for me. But nobody sort of said, hey, you know, this isn't right for you. You need to stop. And in fact, I think in my mind as, you know, a teenage girl who wanted to find an excuse for not eating, it sort of fit really well with it. And so I just was hoping that we could also consider some of the downsides and how that would be important to discuss some of those things in a more open way with people who might be practicing it, especially young women.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I'm somebody who really enjoys open dialogue on these issues. And that's something, too, that a lot of people need to consider as well, is that if fasting becomes a real hardship on you, you need to break your fast. I'm not a Muslim scholar, but I've also encouraged many of my friends who've gotten sick during Ramadan to take days off. And I'm the kind of person who's very obstinate and will not take days off. And I've realized, though, that had I taken a day off, I would have gotten better about a week faster. So those things are actually considered. And there is a dialogue on them because there are a lot of people in our community who suffer from diabetes as well as anemia. So there are exceptions made case by case. But again, you know, fasting isn't supposed to be an extreme hardship. If you do suffer from anemia or other issues, then I think we need to encourage people to speak up about that, definitely. So that's a great point to bring up.
And the caller raised the issue that particularly for young women, there are several eating disorders that fasting would kind of feed, to use a bad word.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is definitely an issue as well. You're still very much encouraged to eat a meal in the evening time. Mm-hmm. Fasting isn't a great way to lose weight, though. You won't lose a large amount of weight because of the way you're eating. However, if there's an eating disorder, you would hope that your family would be able to pick up on that and not think that you're just a hardcore into fasting, because there are definitely other psychological issues to take into consideration.
Now, for a Muslim who fasts during Ramadan, you're not in any way saying that food is bad.
No.
You say that food is good, feeding the body, being healthy is good. But you're giving this up for spiritual reasons. What is the spiritual benefit of fasting for someone in Islam?
Well, I think, and this is this is something I've been thinking about a lot more lately. I have a lot of friends who sometimes do fast and they don't really feel any kind of spiritual revelation or connection. And I think, you know, for fasting, you're very consciously aware of it, and that's important. Because there are many days where you've skipped breakfast, lunch, and dinner, not realized I haven't eaten all day, or I've eaten the night before, and it's 8 p.m. that same day, and you don't feel any kind of spiritual connection or any benefit. It's the consciousness and knowing that you're able to exact a certain amount of self-control of your actions to meet a goal. That goal being an awareness of poverty issues, of issues of the lack of clean water for 1 billion people worldwide, things like that, and the importance of really watching your actions, because fasting isn't really necessarily about food. It's more so your overall conduct.
Now, one of the other requirements for Muslims is charity.
Yes.
And you've talked about being concerned for people in poverty, for those who are without clean water around the world. So in addition to fasting to make yourself, make your you conscious of those people in need, you're also encouraged to give money mm-hmm. to causes which will make a difference.
Definitely.
What are some of those?
Well, you would be encouraged to give money generally locally, wherever you live. So, for example, and you were actually at the Fastathon dinner this year, where the Muslim Students Association coordinated an event where people would come to this dinner at the close towards the end of Ramadan after having fasted an entire day and made a small donation. And that donation went to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, which actually feeds several thousand people in the regional area, people who are not without sufficient amounts of food. And so this kind of action is actually greatly, greatly encouraged during Ramadan. There are always collections made at the mosque. And for just different things, you know, it's not necessarily, the goal isn't necessarily for Muslims to benefit from this. We look at people as people, and people who need food need it, regardless of your religious background.
And not entirely by accident, our guest next week on Keeping the Faith will be a representative from the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So we'll be talking about that part of this issue again next week. Many people don't realize that there are folks who are hungry in East Central Illinois.
Yes.
And may think it's only a problem in other countries. Islam, however, is an international religion, and there are, what were the latest figures, 1.2 billion members of Muslims around the world, of several different types and sorts, but the second largest religion in the world, following only Christianity, with 1.9 perhaps billion adherents around the world. But between the two faiths, it's close to half of the population of the world. How many Muslims are being charitable, are keeping Ramadan by fasting? Do you ever hear reports about that?
Well, no statistical reports, but I found just through personal interactions, you could find someone who's maybe not, you know, a Muslim who's maybe Muslim by cultural background or maybe because their family was Muslim and they don't necessarily complete the five daily prayers. But when Ramadan comes around, you know, they do make an effort to fast and pray regularly. Now, it's encouraged during Ramadan that all of these actions should be something that's carried on throughout the entire year. Hmm. But sometimes, you know, depending on where you are, Ramadan seems to be a great time for that. So I think maybe there's an a heightening of religious practice during Ramadan.
Okay. Let me give our phone numbers once again and encourage listeners who might have a question or comment or who might be willing to share on the air their own experience with fasting as a spiritual exercise. Anywhere the program is heard, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455 or in Champaign-Urbana 333-9455. And we do have another caller on line one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go right ahead.
Yes. Hi. I have two questions. There's such a focus on food in this culture. I wonder if both the personal and professional focus, I know that there is advantage to doing it spiritually fasting, but I think would be difficult, especially during holidays. And so I wonder if our guests could speak to that issue. Because I looked at my Christmas presents, for example, and half of them are food related. So can you speak to that, Mona? And I appreciate very much your willingness to make yourself vulnerable and talk about this issue. Thank you, and I'll listen off the air.
Well, thank you for calling in. Yeah, that's actually a very good point. When I was growing up and when I was fasting, Ramadan came at times when maybe our class was having like a class party or some kind of reward, and so we'd have special pizza days and things like that, or people would be giving gifts and things like just different things, you know, during the day, birthdays and whatnot. So it did become a challenge, and you know, it wasn't necessarily easy, I think, when I was younger. However, with age, I think it became a lot easier. You know, your priorities are different. But again, you know, there is still that temptation. Going to the grocery store while you're fasting is, you know, you learn not to do that later on. But, you know, yeah, it can be difficult, definitely. And there's food is a huge part of our culture. Just even socializing with people, you generally go out to eat or have coffee. So during Ramadan, all of the Muslim girls are kind of confused as to what to do
sure.
to get together.
Sure. The questioner asked about or mentioned the focus on food, particularly in American culture. It's just amazing how much we're reminded of food during a typical day. I have fasted very little in my life, but there was a time when a friend of mine and I in North Carolina decided we would try, both in the Christian tradition, during Lent, to fast one day a week during Lent. But we didn't go without water. We would have water, but we went without food or juice or those sorts of things. And in fact, I wrote a little poem about it that was published, well, it was just published 2 years ago in the National Catholic Reporter during Lent, because fasting is an important part of spirituality for Catholics. And I'll share this with you just because it does respond to the point made by our caller. Fast is the wrong word. The right word is pain or truth or slow. Decision comes first. No, curiosity. Then dreams, imagination, then fear and doubt. We know we've chosen not to eat, only in the middle of the fast. Water has a taste of flavor. Ice is extravagant. We learn food is everywhere. Pictures of food, smells, sounds of food cooking. We spend all day thinking of food. We plan carefully how to break our fast. Ice cream for two. Smugness is a problem. We tell all friends. We feel good about self-denial. Prayer is far from our minds. Still, control, discipline may lead someday to prayer. Small steps for small feet. We learn the power of small things. Fruit, bread. We chew hunger. Well, that's my own little reflection on having tried to fast for, I guess we did it maybe 3 years in a row, and finally one day we did do a fast from, in our tradition, from Maundy Thursday night through Easter Sunday morning. That was the longest fast we had. But again, that we would drink water. Have you ever done any other kinds of fasting except during Ramadan?
No, I think, well, one time I fasted from looking in the mirror as part of a women's studies project, and I found that experience was quite similar to fasting for some reason. Mm-hmm. It was just so out of the usual. Huh. But no, not so much in that respect.
So you gave up looking in a mirror.
Yes, it's very, very ingrained in our culture. There are mirrors at the mall. There are mirrors in your apartment when you brush your teeth.
Just like food is everywhere, mirrors are everywhere.
Exactly. Uh-huh. You would not believe it until you abstained from it.
Oh, interesting. Do you have the sense that when you're fasting, you're thinking of food more than when you're eating regularly?
I think, you know, the first few years of fasting, like that would be all on my mind continually. You'd turn on the television, you'd watch food.
Yeah.
Or sometimes I'd really enjoy watching cooking shows because I could live vicariously through the show. Sort of like your poem, too, which is quite excellent. So I guess that was the case. But now it's more so I'm so busy with schoolwork and writing papers and projects that I tend to forget about it.
We're talking with Mona Haggag, who's a senior in art history at the University of Illinois and a Muslim, about her experience with fasting during Ramadan. each year. We'll be getting back to that topic and our guest in just a few moments, but let me take a minute or two to remind listeners of upcoming programs. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for Keeping the Faith. And next week, I'll have the privilege of talking with Jessica Culp, representing the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, about that social agency's effort to get food to needy people and to make use of some of the excess food that's in our American culture. That's on December 12. Then on December 19, I'll be talking with Ann Heyer, that's H-I-E-R, on faith and politics. Ann has been doing a journalism project on that, and we'll be hearing on Keeping the Faith something a little bit unusual. Instead of me interviewing our guest, in this case, Ann will be bringing recordings of several interviews that she's done on her project. So, December 19th, faith and politics. And then on December 26th, we'll be talking with Harold Quigley about ethical humanism. That's on the 26th of December here on Keeping the Faith, a program on WILL AM 580, a radio service of the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, from 5 to 6 every Sunday Central Time. These Keeping the Faith programs are provided in part by sponsorship from the University YMCA at the University of Illinois, where I'm the executive director. The Campus Y is the oldest student organization, oldest continuous student organization at the university. It was begun by students in 1873, and as a religious organization has been helping develop student leaders by providing opportunities for social action and community service. In its early years, it focused only on Christian students at the university, but for the past many decades has been open to students of all religious backgrounds and programs. In fact, the Muslim Student Association began first at the University of Y some years ago, long before there was a mosque, and so we're very proud of that, helping support and give birth to that important organization for Muslims. The University of Y is a 501c3 charity, and we are able to continue providing leadership opportunities for students and training in good ethics because of the support given by friends of the Y. If you'd like to make a donation, please give me a call, 337-1500, during the week. And we're encouraging people to consider giving cars, motorcycles, boats, pickup trucks, anything with a registration. You can take off as a tax deduction. Up until December 31st, you get to determine the fair value. After that, you can only deduct what we're able to sell that vehicle for. But you can avoid several hassles of selling it yourself or dealing with trade-ins by donating it to a charity. And the University Y is one we encourage you to consider. If you're interested in that, also give me a call during the week, Steve Shoemaker, 337-1500. And just this week, we were promised our first used motorcycle, so we're delighted for that. We'll, I'm sure, sell it to a student who will appreciate it. Okay, back to our guest for today. Before we get back to Mona Hagag, let me just do one other thing very quickly. I've been reading a poem each week recently by our current U.S. Poet Laureate, Ted Kooser, K-O-O-S-E-R, and the publisher of his most recent book, Delights and Shadows, has given me permission to read his work, as well as the poet, who was our guest, some will remember, just a few weeks ago here in the studio. I'd like to read a one-sentence poem by Ted Kooser called A Glimpse of the Eternal. And this is from his book, Delights and Shadows, published just this year by Copper Canyon Press. A Glimpse of the Eternal by Ted Kooser. Just now, a sparrow lighted on a pine bough right outside my bedroom window, and a puff of yellow pollen flew away. Let me read that short poem one more time. A Glimpse of the Eternal by Ted Kooser. Just now, a sparrow lighted on a pine bough right outside my bedroom window, and a puff of yellow pollen flew away. Read by permission of Copper Canyon Press, and the poet Ted Kooser, Delights and Shadows, From Delights and Shadows, his 2004 volume of poetry. Well, after that glimpse of the eternal, do you ever get a glimpse of the eternal when you're fasting?
I think so. I think sometimes I feel like I have a heightened awareness of what's going on around me. I'm really, I guess, very attached to even the small things that I do, you know, smiling at people, watching leaves just move about on the ground. You know, it just kind of, you feel that connection to what's really eternal and to God and spirituality and things like that.
Why does doing without something good make you more sensitive to other good things?
I think when you're sort of really trying to focus on doing something or abstaining from doing something, you have that sense of drive and motivation. I think from drive and motivation, they're very healthy things in an everyday life. And I think from there, I guess my personal experience is that I start to feel a greater sensitivity to what's around me. And I feel like I can understand more and do more.
Now, I'm a little uneasy bringing up this next part of the Muslim practice of fasting because it involves sexuality.
Yes.
And I'm male and you're female and, you know, we don't know each other well or anything. But nevertheless, part of Muslim spirituality in fasting in Ramadan is to do without sexuality,
that's
to not
correct.
Have sexual intercourse with your spouse. Why is that added to already giving up on food and water?
Again, it's something else where it's an issue of self-control, you know, and it's sort of, I think it's also about, you know, abstaining from committing adultery and things like that. It's just kind of really a focus on that issue. I'm actually not married, so that's something that's also, you know, very important for people that aren't married who are Muslim, who are religious and want to abstain from any kind of premarital sex.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think maybe after marriage, that's a blessing that's afforded to you and that's permissible within that bond. However, you should still be able to retain that sense of self-control. And I think maybe that's where that comes in.
Hmm. When Muslim couples practice this kind of abstaining from sex, it is only during the daylight hours.
That's correct.
Right. Okay. So it's not like a Catholic monk or priest or nun would say, I'm going to give up having sex with another person forever.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Is that something that's understandable to Muslims when Catholics make that kind of decision to give up sex for the rest of their lives?
Well, some Muslims, you know, never marry.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess maybe they can understand that or, you know, just different things in their lives. They may have a health condition. However, in Islam, it's encouraged to get married and to have those kinds of relationships and to have offspring as a result. So I think maybe in that respect, it's less comprehensible.
Hmm. We're talking with Mona Haggag about fasting from a Muslim perspective, and want to encourage callers to ask a question, make a comment, or share their own experience from their own religious tradition of fasting. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455 to reach this live call-in show on WILL. 333-WILL in Champaign-Urbana will reach several lines. Elsewhere, you may call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455. One of the things you said early on in the program about fasting was it helps you visualize people in poverty. Now, you were born in Idaho. You've been raised in the United States, which is a very affluent country, where although there is poverty, it's often out of sight. and you were raised by a family where your father's a nuclear engineer, your mother's in business. You've probably not experienced poverty yourself. How can you visualize it? How can you understand what it's like for someone else?
That's actually something very important, because a lot of, I guess a lot of the studies I do are things that are really outside the scope of my immediate experience. Whether it's studying, you know, 1920s surrealist thought or or Latino-Latina culture and immigration issues, those aren't necessarily things that are directly parts of my life. However, I think you understand deprivation, or you may have had some kind of small instance of that, and then to kind of visualize it magnified. And I think strength is always tested in your life, and so when you do have that abstention from food, it's a small thing in comparison to the actual realities of starvation. So I guess, you know, while it doesn't bring me to starvation, it allows me to sort of understand the process and understand what I need to do to solve that problem.
Now, your grandparents are Egyptian. Mm-hmm. Have you traveled to Egypt?
Yes, I've actually traveled to Egypt several times in the past 2 years.
Oh.
As well as I've traveled to Pakistan once as well last winter. So, yeah, I think poverty is a little bit more evident in those cultures and societies, because in the United States, I think poverty is very much segregated off. So you get to see it more. And there's a great emphasis on going out, you know, and distributing food to the poor and things like that. And, you know, people coming to your doorstep or things like that and asking for food, whereas you wouldn't necessarily have that in a gated community in the United States.
Absolutely. Right. When you've traveled to Egypt and Pakistan, have you gone to mosques there?
I actually went to a mosque in Egypt, but that was several years ago. Generally, when I go to Egypt or Pakistan, I haven't really gone to the mosque there. I've been to mosques in Saudi Arabia, however.
Okay. Where else have you traveled?
I have traveled to France and England and Canada.
Okay. Pretty widely traveled for someone who's just a senior in college. Is the way that your relatives in Egypt practiced Islam noticeably different than the way you and your family practice in this country?
I think, I guess my relatives in Egypt are quite amazed that living in the United States that I do wear hijab and cover my hair, and many women in Egypt don't do that, and that I've still held that attachment to my faith. And so I think in Egypt, when you're a majority religion, people assume it's very easy to practice. And sometimes people take religious practice for granted or not necessarily see certain correlations and connections. Because when you're a minority and nobody else is doing what you're doing, you tend to really scrutinize what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think maybe for me, I've had a very, very close scrutiny over Islam and exactly why I practice and is this the right thing for me? And, you know, cross comparisons to other religions. I think maybe the way I practice Islam here in the United States is to really read extensively on religion, diversity, and thought. Whereas I think maybe my relatives in Egypt don't necessarily feel the same emphasis to read the Bible, the New Testament, the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm. When you were a young girl, how did you always wear a head covering?
No, I actually started wearing it the second semester of my sophomore year in college.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. So it was a recent decision.
21 months ago.
And who had you been in conversation with as you came to that conclusion?
I think like everyone,
okay.
Muslim, non-Muslim, you know.
Did your parents encourage that or not?
I actually didn't tell them. I'm a very independent child, and I think, you know, when they let me go to school 500 miles away, they had a lot of trust in my decisions.
Okay.
So I had talked to different people.
Is that a pattern that your mother had practiced?
Yeah. She actually didn't start covering her hair until her late 40s.
So it was a late decision for her.
So it was a late decision. And again, you know, for her, I've always been encouraged to really read and to take a very academic standpoint on things.
Hmm. So you had friends in college who knew you before you started covering your hair.
Yes.
And then others. who have known you only when you've done this, I suppose.
Huh. Yes.
How, you're in art history.
Uh-huh.
So you study paintings of nudes.
Yes.
Figures. How do you as a Muslim deal with that?
I think the other day it kind of occurred to me that, like, I was looking, like, I'm taking Art History 235 with Professor Rosenthal, and she's an excellent professor. I really enjoy her class. And the other day it just kind of occurred to me that, like, a lot of the paintings we look at are, you know, classical painting, are based off of classical works and the human nude. And I think I've kind of desensitized to that. I don't really notice that I'm looking at nudes.
What do you see yourself doing with art history in the future?
Well, I'm not exactly sure right now. I think art history is an extremely valid and important discipline in the sense that you're able to articulate images that are visually placed. So when you study the way paintings are constructed according to sensory perception and how that applied to the audience, you can also decipher advertising in contemporary culture. You know, whether it's comparing the advertisements of the Democrats and the Republicans and the Libertarians in the election and what those design motifs speak to in the culture. And so you're able to form that ability to speak to different issues. And I think that's important in understanding even business meetings and things like that. I'm actually planning on doing a master's in business right now. Mm-hmm. Maybe later on doing a PhD in art history or education. So I think art history really functions to develop a student, whether or not they're doing their master's in it.
So the teachings of Islam for someone who is a student, a scholar, don't forbid the looking at representations of the naked human body.
Actually, I guess in other cultures, for example, like my mother was hesitant to become an art major when she was choosing colleges because she had heard that they were doing life drawing or, you know, painting of a live nude. And so she didn't feel comfortable with that, and her family didn't feel comfortable with that, so she didn't pursue it.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't taken life drawing. I think I feel really awkward seeing an actual live nude person and drawing them. However, I guess my standpoint on that is probably different from the mainstream, and I think I handle it in a very decent manner, I suppose.
Okay. Let me explore a little bit about what the Islamic understanding is of the legitimacy of representing the divine in terms of art. I know that in Judaism, for example, that Jews are told not to make any image of God. And in Christianity, however, there have been many images of Jesus who is understood as divine down through the centuries. Where is Islam as an art history major on those issues?
Well, actually, Islam has always taken the same standpoint as in Jewish religion and culture, that the divine should not be visually represented in that respect. So it's definitely a different way of practicing religion. A lot of the work I do is focusing on early Christian art, post and counter-reformation. So I think it's really an emphasis on idealizing values of the religion as opposed to imagery, so as to prevent idolatry, not to say that it occurs, but rather to show that it is different. It's a different way of practicing. There are definitely good points about either practice and faith. I think it's truly according to what people do with it, because I think even if you don't have religious imagery, certain things can be worshipped that are definitely askew within religion.
We're down to our last 10 minutes with our guest Mona Haggag here on Keeping the Faith this Sunday afternoon. Let me encourage listeners again to call and share an experience of fasting or to ask a question or make a comment. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. So, in representing God, Muslims, what about the Prophet? Are there representations in art of Muhammad?
I've actually come across a few instances. However, those have been very obscure. It wasn't until about 5 centuries after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, where any kind of human or animal imagery showed up in anything that would be considered Islamic art or Islamic art productions. And that was because people understood that later on, because there were certain bans and there are certain religious traditions that discouraged it, then people came to understand, which is a reason why Muslims, you know, there was sometimes a debate on whether or not to have photographs of your family in your home. And later on, the ruling, the most widespread ruling, was that if you're not worshiping it, it's all right. But there's a diversity of opinion on that. But so far as the Prophet Muhammad, no, you know, it's very, very rare to come across something like that. And even in films that document the life of the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, you know, they're very creative in not showing his face.
Interesting. Now, Islam is different from other world religions in that there is no professional clergy. There's no, there are scholars. And in some parts of Islam, there are religious interpreters, I guess, of the tradition, teachers of the tradition. How has that been for you as a student who's trying to learn more and more about how to practice Islam when there's not an authority sort of to go to about it?
Well, usually a mosque will have an imam. Mm-hmm. However, the imam will not always be the one to give the Friday sermon because it's encouraged, I guess, in many ways, to kind of explain it maybe other terms like sort of a priesthood of all believers, although we don't have a priesthood. In the sense that people who get up can talk about their religious experience. However, they can't issue fatwas or sort of like religious
teachings
and things like that, like a ruling. So I think, you know, growing up, I read a lot of books. You know, I was also in Tennessee, so it wasn't like I could consult the scholars who have spent 20 years or, you know, 5 decades of their life really studying and then fully understanding. However, they had books published, so I bought them and read them.
We have a couple callers waiting. Let's go to line one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Mona Haggag. Yes.
Yes. It's obvious from listening to you that you have thought about your faith very deeply for a very long time. And this is not really about fasting, but I'm wondering if you could tell me, what is it about Islam that is most important to you, or what is its essence for you?
Oh wow, that's an hour long program in itself. It's a very good question too. I think it comes down to, for Islam, for me, it's not necessarily about these really large issues. Granted, I'm a very, I guess, big picture inclined person where I want to change the world and I want to do all these things on a large scale. However, it comes down to, and this is something you hear a lot, a smile is charity. And it's just a smile. And to know that that small thing in your life is recognized by God and it's recognized as being something that's really celebrated and beautiful, to me, it's those things like that. It's the feeling I gather from focus in a short prayer. We pray 5 times a day. You know, I don't know, I can almost get emotional about this because I've done so much reading and so much scrutiny over it, and I've come to this sort of, I guess, peace when I really understood it.
Would you share that prayer with us?
Oh, well, actually, it's physical prayer. You know, some of the introductory prayers are done in Arabic where you recite chapters from the Quran. You say things like Subhana Rabbi al-Azim, you know, or it's sort of like giving recognition to God as being the greatest, Allahu Akbar. Different words like this are recited in the prayer, and there are different stages of movement in it. You're actually welcome to come to the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, which is located on 106 South Lincoln Avenue in Urbana. And, you know, you can come in and observe the prayers and see us actually pray.
And see the bodily movement that accompanies the prayers. And we do have another caller on line two. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. The question for – I started actually listening to the program just about 10 minutes ago. But the question – maybe you did discuss this. Reading a book about lost Christianity recently, I read about the extended fasting that was prescribed in some Christian groups. if Mona knows about it, or the host, either one of you, if you could elaborate on the connection between early forms of fasting that existed in Christianity and the way that it is practiced in Islam.
I'll give this to Steve.
Well, it's certainly true that in early Christianity, fasting was seen as very important. It was carried over from practices in Judaism, but early Christianity followed some of those traditions, although there are parts in the New Testament where in the Gospels and in the book of Acts, Jesus is quoted as saying, you should do fasting privately, you shouldn't tell anybody about it, it should be a very, very, very personal thing. And trying to avoid the sin of pride, which for Christians is very important, as we learn, it's also very important for Islam. But particularly in certain forms of Christianity, there were extended forms of fasting that that are just hard to even imagine, and came, and many people came to feel were went too far. Any response, Mona, in terms of Islam? Can people fast too much in Islam?
Well, there's actually a saying of the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. We say alayhi salatu salam in Arabic, is that one person came to him and he said, "Well, I'm not going to ever eat during the daytime," and
for a whole lifetime.
For a whole lifetime. Mm-hmm. Another person said, "I will never take a wife." And another person said, "I will never sleep during the night. I will pray the entire night." Mm-hmm. The Prophet said to each of those things, you know, that's not part of my life, and this is not of me. You know, the Prophet Muhammad, while he was known for doing a lot of day fasting and a lot of all-night prayers and things like that, he also ate during the day, and I think Muslims need to bear in mind that moderation is what's going to keep you consistent. Mm-hmm. So that's basically the philosophy of the Islamic faith.
I want to thank our guest, Mona Haggag, who is a senior in art history at the University of Illinois, and a practicing Muslim, about sharing her experiences with fasting during Ramadan. I want to thank also our callers who have asked good questions and comments, as often happens on this program. We're blessed with a marvelous audience. Next week we'll be talking about the one of the things that Mona mentioned. She said that during her fast, and many Muslims here at CIMIC gave money to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank as part of their charity during Ramadan. And we have a representative from the food bank coming next week, December 12th. That's Jessica Culp, who will be our guest on Keeping the Faith. On December 19, we'll be talking with Ann Heyer about a journalism project she's done on the topic of faith and politics. And then the final Sunday in December, our guest will be Harold Quigley, talking about ethical humanism. Those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host, and thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Zoo Theater Company, the people who brought you Ain't Misbehavin', presenting Stephen Schwartz's Godspell, December 10th, 11th, and 12th at the Virginia Theater in downtown Champaign. Showtimes are 7:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday, with 2:30 p.m. Saturday and Sunday matinees. Tickets available at the Virginia Theater box office, 356-9063.
Book critic Dale Peck is known as the Hatchet Man. He's trashed some of the biggest names in American fiction. He's even called James Joyce's Ulysses a hoax upon literature. Peck's brutal reviews have raised a basic question: can a critic be too savage? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Dale Peck and some of his critics. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 Central Time, here on WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, rain likely with areas of fog after midnight. The low in the lower 40s with southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, cloudy with a chance of showers in the afternoon. The high in the mid-50s with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, showers likely. The low in the lower 40s with southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour in the evening, shifting to the south 15 to 20 miles per hour after midnight. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life.